I'm going to take a minute here and click through the rest of the slides to show you the next 8 points in case anybody wants to ask a question about them, but we're not going to talk about them. And then we're going to open up for questions. We've got some online questions and just some dialogue and discussions. Number 13 was thinking if we don't let them do this, they might rebel and leave the church. Well, what good is being in the church if they aren't in the Lord? Number 14 was, come on, 14. And there's some things about clothing and stuff. Assuming cultural norms. Well, twos are going to be terrible. Teens are going to be rebellious. And then they're going to be ungodly adults, too. It's a general pattern. Don't go into defense mode when your children are wrong. Failing to train humility. This is a really big thing that I've been noticing in religious families and conservative families. And you end up with a bunch of pride and don't train humility. That's no good. Focusing over home income instead of home outcome, especially in our culture of all full-time jobs and everything. Underestimating threats, bunch of stuff from the internet, the media, the school system, etc. Lowering the bar from the firstborn to the baby. And then lastly, just talking about different types of personalities in children, like pleaser versus strong-willed and stuff. So if you want to, you can ask some questions about those, but otherwise we're going to focus on the questions that you have here. I'm going to get to the written questions in a minute, but I want to first open up to any questions or comments that you might have here. Now I'll start with a written question. What role, if any, should fear play into parenting? Certainly no one wants to encounter either side of discipline, but is it okay if your kid is scared of the consequences? How do you keep that distance so they aren't scared of you? So let's start with that, right? So were you scared of your dad? Some people are scared of their dad because they don't know what to expect. In my case, I knew what to expect. And that's two different, very different things. So does the Bible teach us to fear God? Give me a passage or two that says fear God.
Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God is bringing every work into judgment, completing every secret thing, whether good or evil.
Yes, sir. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Peter talks about love the brotherhood, fear God. What does John say about fear in his first epistle?
Punishment.
And perfect love casts out fear. And in 1 John, how is perfect love? What is love described as? This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. So if we've been washed in the blood of Christ and we're walking with God, should you be afraid of God? If we've been washed in the blood and we're walking with him, because see,
we ought to be afraid of what he can do.
Yes, and so that gets into the consequences thing, but not him. So that's why John says perfect love casts out fear. You know, and he also defined love. Here's how we know that we love God, 1 John 2, around verse 3 or 4, that we keep his commandments. So it's like I was in an aquarium one time and I'm on a walkway over an open pit full of sharks. I wasn't scared because I was walking where I was supposed to walk. What if I was hanging over the side or dabbling? I'd be scared, you know, because I was where I wasn't supposed to be. So likewise, I think with earthly fathers, they should be scared of disobeying us. And man, I'll get in trouble. That's healthy. But not, I don't know what dad's gonna do. You know, dad comes home drunk and you get beat. Dad comes home, it shouldn't be the fear of not knowing what to expect, but there should be a healthy respect for knowing what to expect.
Would you say there's a very fine line between respect and fear? My 7-year-old daughter asked me this and she's thinking it's odd that we tell her to fear the Lord, and she learns that in church, and she's relating it to the type of fear that she has when she watches a ghost or a scary movie, the trembling type of fear. In our whether right or wrong, I think there's some truth, a lot of truth to it. It's not so much the fear that he's going to do something bad for you, this unpredictableness is you're speaking to, but the respect that he's going to do what he says he's going to do. And that
right.
is the type of fear that we should have for him. The respect that he's going to deliver the consequences, good or bad, that he says he's going to deliver. And we can trust each and every time when we cross him that that is going to be the case. And that's the type of fear that we should have for the Lord and
yes.
therefore for our parents as well.
Yes. So it's not knowing what to expect, like with ghosts. Man, what's that ghost going to do? You know, it's in the movie. But with God, it's like the local sheriff or something. You know, you're doing what you're supposed to do. You say, hey, sheriff, if you rob the bank, it's going to be a different story. You know, so it's like there should be a fear of doing the wrong thing and being trouble with the authority, not the personal fear of not knowing what to expect. All right. Do you think when we are raising our children to be godly, we can inadvertently push them away from having interest in church by forcing them to participate just as much as we as adults understand we should? So this is a good question. Don't make your kids put on like a performance, or like you know, you should be baptized. You're making us look bad, or you should be baptized. The other boys are leading singing. That's horrible. You know, let them. You know, should but neither should you say, well, the five-year-old says he's tired and doesn't want to go to church. It's boring, so he can stay home. No, you're going to go, but their spiritual relationship needs to come from them. So Robert Turner once said, God has no grandchildren. What do you think he meant by that? God has no grandchildren.
For all his children.
Yeah. He has sons and daughters, not grandsons. Now, you can benefit from your parents and grandparents, like Timothy did, Lois and Eunice, but each generation has to make their faith their own. So we can train them, bring them to church, bring them to Bible classes, be training them, teach them when they're little to have a respect and obey you. That if they'll learn to deny self and respect authority, and be able to have self-control when they're little before you, you've already given them most of the tools for getting ready to submit to God. And then let them submit to God. But don't make it a thing for other people. That needs to be from them. What can you do to keep good behaviors in teens as they get more freedom? I want to open that one up for some discussion. What can you do to keep good behaviors in teens as they get more freedom? Brian.
I think we already discussed that. You have to lay the foundation in the first 10 years. You're not going to bring a 15-year-old, 16-year-old boy into submission to you or in respect to you if that child didn't have it at age 5 or at age 10. I remember often telling my kids, I said, you're getting a spanking now because there's going to come a time when I can't spank you.
Yeah.
And then you will have enough respect for me that you will, that you wouldn't need that type of reprimand. But they're going to face all kinds of challenges, particularly now. And you've got to set that, set them on course now because they're going to be tested and they're going to fail.
And some other things we can do also is, so getting that important foundation when they're young, that really does cover so much of it. And then when they're teens, give them opportunities to be around other good teens, because peer pressure is a powerful thing, whichever way it's going. And by the way, a good peer pressure group doesn't just mean kids that go to church. There are kids that go to church and then get together and watch dirty movies and do drugs and get drunk and stuff like that. I knew a guy who grew up in a denominational church, and he said their youth group, you know, would go do drugs and stuff. I mean kids that are actually involved, where they're encouraging and being encouraged. We, for years at Gettysburg, for years and years and years, maybe a couple of decades, the teenagers on Friday nights. They got together at somebody's house for a Bible study. And then games and stuff afterwards.
Also, as teens, you got to teach them how to make decisions. I'm a police chief at a university, and I see it all the time. There's kids that come to school that don't even know how to make decisions on their own. And that's part of that teenage, is you're guiding them. My kids were amazed when they became seniors, and I said, you make your decisions. And they were like, what? I said, now I got a trump card. You're still living here, but you need to make the decision, and I need to see that process of how you're making those decisions so that they're ready when they get out there that they can make those decisions.
I remember when I was about 20 maybe or so, and I'd been asked to work at a church, and I wasn't sure if I should go there or not, and I asked my dad, and he said, well, you're going to have to decide that. Dad! It's like, all these years you've been telling me what to do, when I didn't always want to hear it, and now I'm asking, and now you won't tell me what to do. He said, well, you're old enough and mature enough, you got to make that decision. And we need to be preparing boys to be men. We haven't talked about that, but our culture is encouraging boys to be boys, even when they're adults, and not good ones. We need to train boys to be men and learn how to work.
One other thought about teenagers. Again, in the first 10 years, you have, at 10 years old, you have the larger version of the younger child.
Yeah.
But in the teenage years, they go from a child's body into an adult body just extraordinarily quickly. Yeah. And in addition, those are the letting go years. The parents have to start letting go, granting, it's a power struggle. The child needs to take on, and the teenager and the young man, young woman have to start taking on more authority and responsibility for themselves, and the parents have to start letting go. And there's where the conflict comes. The parents are concerned about maybe letting go too much, or the child taking too much leeway or too much authority on their own behalf, and vice versa, the child thinking they're not getting enough authority and empowerment. And I don't know the answer, but you've got to work on that to get the proper blend. So, because let's face it, by the time they're 16 or 17, for all practical purposes, they're out on their own, other than the fact that they probably still need to be educated in college or something like that. But at 17, you go off to war.
And at 16 and 17, they're still not paying the bills. And they need to understand that. It's like when you have your own place, and you can have some different rules, but have good rules. And I encourage my kids, hey, pass us up. You know, it's like, I don't want them to stay under me. But also, the more you see them making good decisions, the more you entrust decisions to them. And then, like you said, you got a trump card. If they're like doing really boneheaded, now it's time to reel them back in and have some accountability because of that. One other good way to do it, get them involved in service. I mean, let them do fun stuff. You know, let them, you know, go out and play ball and do things with their friends and go fishing, do whatever their hobbies are, let them have some fun. But like, you know, go over to the widow's house and help do some house repair over there, or clean the yard up, or some, you know, get them involved with a group of people that are actually also thinking about serving other people. Because young people can be a great, great source of encouragement like that. You know, go down to, if there's some shut-ins from the church down at the senior center or something, go down there and do a singing with them sometime. Have your Bible study down there sometime. They'll love it, you know, and then it teaches the teens, you know, to think about something besides just their group.
New question, if that's okay, or are we?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe just so I was going back to your mistakes number three, the expecting misbehavior. So maybe some additional clarification or commentary around it. So I think I understand your point about not letting our kids, to a certain degree, dictate our lives, what we do and what we don't do, right?
Right.
So how would we? Because I do think there are situations where statistically it's a higher likelihood that we're going to have a problem in this set of circumstances. So again, maybe thinking the extreme here. So I guess what's the balance between avoiding those situations
either entirety or pieces of them, versus, hey, we're not going to let our kids, again, dictate what we do, what we don't do, because it's a learning, especially in today's world where, depending on where you are, probably the response is going to be different, public versus private, things of that nature.
So let's take two things on far ends of the spectrum. If there's a scary movie and everybody wants to bam, I want to watch a scary movie, and you got one kid that's kind of a sensitive nature and they get nightmares and stuff, I don't want to have nightmares. Suck it up, kid, you know, and you're going to watch this, you know, you don't want to put a child through something like that. You can take into consideration, you know, what's going to bother them or something like that. But where we're talking about a behavior thing, like a moral thing, here's good behavior, here's bad behavior. My child has this bad behavior, and I just give in on that and throw in the towel, and mentally I've just decided, well, that's the way they're going to be. You know, this 12-year-old is going to be lazy and he's never going to work. This 10-year-old is a liar and I'm never going to be able to trust him. Stop that. Whose job is it to train that 10-year-old to tell the truth? Your job. Whose job is it to train that 12-year-old to stop being lazy and learn how to work? Your job. So one is realizing this won't work for this child because of some circumstance. The other is, no, this is a character issue. This is a real character issue. And obviously, every one of our kids are going to have character deficiencies because they're not born mature. You know, nobody ever came out of the womb saying, hey, what can I do to help? You know, they're not born mature. And so what we want to do is not throw in the towel and keep lowering the bar because we didn't do our job and then just assume they're going to keep failing. That's what I'm kind of getting at.
Going to the restaurant, it's not fun, it's not worth the money, you know, that's, but okay, fine, then go home and don't let them do whatever they want. They're going to sit at the
right.
Home table. We're going to take it, maybe we steer it, but it's yeah. Going to be a different effort to
yeah.
Teach the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. And and if they're acting badly, say, you know what, the rest of the family is going to have banana splits after supper. Everybody's pitching a fit is not getting it. You know, and kids don't like getting left out. You know, don't bribe your kids. You know, if you'll stop screaming, you know, I'll give you $1. Man, you're going to have a screamer, you know, because he's got to learn how to. But there's a difference between bribing and rewarding. You know, in the Bible, does God promise some good things for people that do things right? Does God promise some bad things for people that do things wrong? Pain and pleasure are motivators, you know, and motivates kids. Here's a couple other questions. A big aim of mine is not to yell. It seems as though sometimes a gruff voice or heightened volume, okay, fine, I'm yelling, because I've said it nicely 5 times already, is the only way to get them to tune in and take action. What tools get results to avoid yelling? Very good question. So back up, and this is so easy to get into. I think probably most of us have done this sometimes. Back up, and when they ignored you the first time or two, already bring consequences. You don't have to make it, you know, capital punishment, but like, you know, you've told them to get up from the video game and they didn't. You know, walk over, unplug it. Hey, I was in that. Yeah, you were also being disobedient. I told you to go do your work. Now come here, you know, now go do your work or whatever. Or that's $1, or what, you know, just some kind of consequences so that they don't get away with ignoring and ignoring and ignoring without consequence. That causes us to want to then get more and more aggravated. So we want to call them to stop ignoring. And so many parenting, last question on this, and then I want to get more of yours. So many things preach the same free parenting. They say shame leads to dysfunctional relationships with your kids and lying. Shame is a huge part of our reaction to sin. How do you prevent your children from being crippled by their shame and trying to hide their mess ups? So this, yeah, it's very popular right now to say that we shouldn't feel guilty or shouldn't feel shame. thinking about the Word of God, who would be behind that message? The fact that the Bible is kind of pretty clear that we've done some shameful things that we need to acknowledge and feel guilty about. Now, Satan gets his way if we don't feel guilty enough to change. Like, if all of us go from here and just go out and start doing sinful things this afternoon without it phasing us, is Satan pleased? Yeah. We brought up pornography earlier. Suppose all of us leave here and go walk out of the building and start downloading pornography, and it doesn't faze us. Satan's happy. All right? We need to feel shame for what's shameful. How much shame should we feel? Enough to change. To say, oh, like the song we sing, "Oh, you who are weary of sin." Jesus says, "Come unto me, all you are laden and heavy laden, I will give you rest." Come, bring our sins of broken life in repentance to God. Now, on the day of Pentecost, when they found out the guy you killed is the Messiah, verse 37 says, when they heard this, they were pricked to the heart. Did they feel shame? Guilt? Yeah, and they should. And Peter said, and they said, what do we need to do? And Peter said, and for thee. And 3,000 did it. And then by the end of the chapter, they are continuing with gladness of heart. For it's a shame. They repented. When God forgives us, we also need to forgive ourselves. The rich young ruler comes to the Lord. The Lord sees his problem and says, give it up. And he doesn't want to, so he went away sorrowfully. The Ethiopian eunuch said, here's water. What does hinder me to be baptized? And he went his way rejoicing. There's a big difference. 2 Corinthians 2. Sinner at Corinth has been punished by the church. Now he's repented. Paul says, now that he's repented, confirm your love to him and forgive him so that he not be swallowed up with overmuch sorrow. You see the overmuch? So I wrestle. And if I'm trying to flip you and you are really braced in good and I cannot flip you and you're doing everything you can to resist that flip, you know what I need to do? Send you the other way. If you're putting all your energy in making sure that I don't roll you this way, let me just grab some of that energy and send you the other way. So if Satan's looking at me or you, and it's like, I don't care, I'm going to keep doing this. I'm not ashamed, I'm not embarrassed, I don't care. Satan's like, that's great, that's great. Then he sees me repent. I feel shame and guilt and I repent. That's not good news for Satan. But what if he can get me to stay in shame, even after I've forgiven? Now that's too much sorrow. So what if Paul, each morning, Timothy says, let's go. And Paul goes, I can't. I just keep seeing Stephen. And there I was glad it was happening. And I remember those women that I tied up and those men that I beat. Who am I to go to preach Christ? Who's winning? Mm-hmm. So what does Paul say? I was the chiefest of sinners, but he also says what? Forgetting the things that are behind, pressing on to the things that are before. Does your car have a rearview mirror? How big is it? Small. Does your car have a windshield? How big is it? What would you buy a car that had a rear view mirror this big and a windshield this big? No, you wouldn't. Why? Because where you're going is much more important than what's behind you. And we need to remember that. We can learn some lessons about the past, but who we choose today is more important, be today is more important than where we were yesterday. And it's the same with our kids. If they're doing something shameful, they should be ashamed. And it, what do we talk about over and over? When the little child is punished, after his punishment, what do you say needs to happen? He needs to say what? I'm sorry, and he needs to get what? A hug. Where's the shame? It's gone. So keep that, start that from early and keep that going, and then you have a child who's got that.
It seems to me like there's probably going to be a fine line with that technique in teaching your child to have the right amount of shame and then embracing them when they try and change and do the right thing. But they may do it again. I totally lost where I was going with that.
let me tell a story while you're rethinking it.
Okay.
One way to tell where your kids are is to just look what they're doing. If you say, I don't see any drug use, you know, I'm not finding any beer bottles, you know, I haven't heard any curse words, they're okay. Look for the signs that they're actually doing okay. You know, if they said, hey, I was thinking maybe next Saturday we could, you know, get a singing together over at the old folk, you know what, that's a good sign. Hey, Dad, I was, you know, my buddy and I were studying yesterday, we were looking at this verse in James. What does this mean? You see what I'm saying? So one time, one of mine, he was about 11, maybe 10, maybe 11, and he came into the room. It was in the evening. He had a belt, and he said, I need a spanking. And I said, why? He said, Mom asked me if I brushed my teeth, and I thought about saying that I did, and I hadn't. I said, Mom sent you up here? No. You didn't talk to Mom about this? No. So you didn't brush your teeth? No, I brushed my teeth. So you thought about saying you brushed your teeth, and then you decided not to lie, and you feel you need a spanking, and that's why it comes. I said, Luke, I'm proud of you. I said, there's a difference between, you know, temptation's gonna come along, thoughts gonna come in your mind. Thing is, you chose to do the right thing. It's gonna be lots of times in life where you have to choose to do the right thing, and you chose to do the right thing. I'm proud of you for that. But since because he felt he deserved it, I said, since you think you deserve it, I said, I'll give you one, but it's gonna be super soft. I took the belt and I tapped it against him. I said, you did good. I said, this is little things like that. Watch for, you know, because so when I'm seeing that hard in my child, when they tell you the truth, when they could have easily lied, that's a good sign. Don't evaluate where they are just on, I don't see flames. You know, evaluate they are on, do you see, you know, good trees bear good fruit, you know, and help them there. And don't push them to become a Christian before they're ready. Luke didn't become a Christian until this summer. And I didn't push him at all. And I waited till he got there. And he was close to 17 before he did. But he's taking it very, very seriously. You know, but, you know, evaluate where they're at based on choices they're making. Other questions? Oh, yeah, come back. Did you remember what it was? All right.
I'll be interested to see how you answer this and relate this to biblical teaching. To what extent should we allow ourselves, maybe not be vulnerable, but to, in the deeper discussions we have with perhaps our older kids, talk about those experiences that we've had where we've done things that were wrong. And I look at my dad, and my dad's never done any wrong in his life, although I know he's probably had a beer before, but I know of no instance, I've never heard him say a curse word. I know of no instance of his childhood that he's ever related to me, hey, son, I've been there, I've done that. And should we, because I think we've all done, and I've certainly had my fair share of things that I'm not proud of, that I think I can really relate to a kid going through something and understand that I've been there and hey, this is what we need to do and how you need to think moving forward to overcome this. But is that condoning it in a sense?
I think that's key, how we do it. And so this is a judgment question. Like, there's not a verse in the Bible that tells us, don't tell them what you did, do tell them what you did. But the Bible does say, do all things unto edifying. So if I say, hey, you know, just want you to let you know, because this is the conversation that parenting magazines would like us to have with kids. Just want you to know, your mom and I, you know, slept with a lot of different people, you know, and didn't always have safe sex and lots of drugs and everything. And if you want to talk to us about these things, you can, you know, that's not a good message. Whereas if you said, here's a situation I was in one time, and here's what I foolishly did, and here's a lesson I learned from it. You know, maybe I spent the night in jail or whatever. And what I learned from that is this. That's not glorifying it. You know, so do all things unto edifying. Is this message or information going to give them an excuse to say, well, Dad did it? Or is it going to help them realize, wow, that's some good advice from Dad. I don't want to do that. I think that's key. I had a conversation with my youngest just recently where, you know, I talked about a foolish decision I'd made. I think we should be, I'm going to come back one more time to this idea of like apologizing to our kids. You don't need to do it all the time by any means, but have we ever lost our temper and spoken to our kids or families in ways we shouldn't have? Have we ever done something unfair or not, you know, listened to them or something, you know, reacted before we understood? Not admitting that is not strength. Not admitting that doesn't reinforce our authority. Because if we're messing up, they saw that. When you see people in authority over you, if your boss does something really stupid and messes it up and blames it on you or somebody else, does that convince you, wow, he's the greatest? No. If he comes to you and says, hey, I want to apologize. I blamed that shipping order on you, and I just looked and realized I had, you know, told you to do those things. That was my mistake. Sorry about that. Good work. Does that make you think he's a jerk and you don't need to listen to him anymore? How does that make you feel, your boss, when he does that? That's a good guy. You know, so when we should be open enough with our kids. We need to be the one in authority, but we also need to be honest. And to their benefit, maybe tell them something we learned a stupid way, or maybe not, thinking about what is beneficial. Think about how we tell it. Think about what age they are. Thinking about the personality of the child. So lots of judgment in there for the individual dad, individual child.
God says, don't sin in your anger. I doubt that there's a parent in this room and a father in this room that hasn't been angry with their children when they do bad things. I don't think anger is the sin. Right. It's overreacting and losing your temper when you do foolish things in your anger.
Yes. So Ephesians chapter 4 says, be angry and sin not. Because when we're angry, it's easy to sin. But being angry is not itself sinful. In the early Gospel of Mark, Jesus at the synagogue, there's a guy with a shriveled up hand, and Jesus is about to heal him, and he looks around and he sees all these people sitting there waiting to see, are you going to heal him so we can accuse you? And the text says Jesus looked around with what? Anger. Anger in itself is not wrong. but it doesn't generally do good. The wrath of man doesn't produce the righteousness of God, James chapter 1. So here's some differences between righteous anger and unrighteous anger. James says, be slow to wrath. Not quick-tempered, slow to wrath. Ephesians says, be angry and don't sin. Once you're angry, stay in control. And then Ephesians says, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. So righteous anger should be not something you just pop off with. Slow to wrath, stay in control, and let it go away. Unrighteous anger can be, bam! You know, well, I just got a short fuse. Well, then you need to lengthen it. And then out of control, and then there's the people. I remember what she said in 1973, you know, and that type of thing. So, yeah, there's going to be times when our kids do things and we're angry. What might be a good idea then, if my child has done something, it's not he accidentally knocked over that vase. You know, maybe I said, hey, Jaden, catch. And he missed it and it hit the vase. Why didn't you touch it? You know, it's not his fault, you know. But there are going to be times when we're angry and they have done something wrong. What might be a good way to handle that?
Cool down.
Yeah, take a minute. Say, you sit there and say, I'm angry right now, and I want to think about how to handle this. And while I'm thinking about that, I need you to sit right there and think about what you've done. And step out of the room. Give yourself a chance to calm down. Because when we're angry, we describe when we lose our temper as what? I lost my head. And why is that a fit description? We think stupid. You know, it's right when we're angry. This all makes sense. 15 minutes later, if you look back, if somebody filmed it, ooh, that was some overreaction. So sometimes giving yourself a chance to calm down. There's times it's appropriate to be angry. Absolutely, but we need to be careful with it. Handle it. It's like gasoline. You don't just pour it into the open bed of your pickup truck. It's a powerful thing. We need to be careful with it. Good question. Any other questions?
In regards to that being angry and not being crossing that line between anger and sin, I guess, if my son's pretty young, so I can't really get angry at him for too many things. But there's definitely been times where he throws a temper tantrum and doesn't listen after telling him not to do things multiple times. And I'll raise my voice. There's a lot of studies, psychological studies, that say when somebody's in a certain state of mind, do something to get them out. That will shake them up and just change their state of mind momentarily so you can get across the point. And biblically, to me, that's spanking or disciplining your child. So anyway, I guess what I was gonna say is some people are more sensitive to those situations where you raise your voice or you show discipline, because from how they grew up as a child, those were the times that were the scariest.
Yeah,
the most
yeah.
ineffective way yeah, to yeah, discipline yeah. them. So right. How do you, navigating
yeah.
that?
Yeah, so several things to think about there. One is tone of voice doesn't mean, like, I think there's appropriate times for a firm tone of voice. You know, we are not going to put up with that. If I see any more of that, you're not going to the party. You know, a firm tone of voice can make something clear, doesn't it? Well, maybe, we won't go to the party. Sometimes firmness is helpful, but there's a difference between firmness and that screaming, yelling, out of control stuff. Sometimes there's gruffness, though, that's not near as effective as calmly, saying something. And so you can find some adjustment there, and with the child and stuff. And then you got to take into consideration other people in the family, too. I know in my family, sometimes my voice, when I feel I'm being firm, gets interpreted by somebody else as being something else. And that sometimes is a gender difference as well. And then sometimes maybe if we heard a tape recording, we would hear it a little differently. Have you ever, in an argument, talked about how somebody else said something, and then you said this, and you repeated it in a tone, you know, and you step it up a bit, and they step it up a bit. So be careful, but a firmness in a tone can be helpful. But when we get out of control, it's not easy to, you know, the kids, we can't expect our kids to be in control when we're out of control. And so a calm voice can also be a firm voice, you know, where dad said it, that's it, you know, getting that idea across. And with little ones, sometimes there's a question, how much do they understand? Did they understand or not? And I'd lean into, if you're not sure if they understood or not, benefit of the doubt goes to the kid. But if you know they understand, then consequences. And maybe it's a spanking, or, okay, this toy is going away, you know. And now a little bitty kid, they're not going to understand the difference between 5 minutes and 5 years. But they can understand some things. It's like, you know, they don't get this. The consequences is that they start understanding, wow, I'm making things worse for myself.
Yeah, to that point, so I've got a 2-year-old, and you know, I've thought several times during today's lessons of times where, like, for example, we're in worship service and she's not listening to us saying, you know, sit still, don't talk, don't do this or that. I have to take her out, and I'll take her back to one of the classrooms, and I'll say, okay, well, did you listen? Did when we told you not to, you know, fidget or move around or get off the seat? Did you listen when we told you not to talk? And she can usually, you know, answer me, and I'll say, okay, well, this is why we're back here. This is why I got to give you a spanking. But there are times where I feel like, man, I'm talking to a 2-year-old. Right. How much are they actually getting it?
Yeah.
And if they aren't, it, you know, it, at a minimum, I would think that it's setting the precedent of, for myself anyway, on how I'm going to try to discipline moving forward as they do get older. But
and,
it,
and when
it
they don't, when they don't understand, you don't want to discipline them away where they, then they could develop a fear of, man, sometimes he whacks me and I don't know why. But when they understand, like for instance, a small child in a lap, it's going to be hard for them to sit like this. But you know that, like when you put them in your lap and they go, and they throw that back and they try to bang you with their head and stuff, you know, it's like, you know, or something. I don't know, one mom. No, I'm not gonna tell it. So you gotta, you know, there's some age progression thing there, but when they understand, then let them get used to that idea of accountability. And if you take them out and they get to play in the nursery for 15 minutes, man, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to squirm it. So when I was one and a half or something, what the people remembered was me yelling, I'll be good, because mom would start walking toward the back and they'd hear me going, I'll be good, I'll be good. So I understood what was going on here, and I was trying to negotiate my way out of that. And again, it doesn't need to be a whole lot, just that kind of sense of accountability in getting them trained. Sometimes, I've known of moms who at home practice, you know, sitting still. It's okay, now let's sit still, like suppose it was church time. Let's sit still and let's read a book. And I know one girl, she put some of the favorite toys in a circle. It said, now you can play with those after we sit still and read the story. And just, you know, learning some self-restraint. And no, you have to wait. And then when you sit still for the story, okay, now you can go play. And then just, you know, learning some just skills and that type of thing. And then you can also let dad hold them for a while, let mom hold them for a while. I used to do little finger games and stuff with them that didn't require much. I'd draw little faces on different fingers and, you know, show them just, you know, just to amuse a 1 or 2 year old or something, where they're not being noisy, but they're not catching that sermon on Calvinism anyway. any final question?
One of the most pressing things on my mind and my wife's mind is not something we're encountering right now, but in the next 2 or 2.5 years, as he's getting to the point where he is going to be schooled in some way, we would love to probably homeschool him, because we are so fearful of the influences of the outside world. And I think, as Brian said earlier in his prayer, times are different than they were when the scriptures were written, in that our children are bombarded with media, as you said, that is always has an agenda to influence them to make a decision to do something or to not to do something. And it's just hard to, my profession is a software engineer. I have to be on a computer all day, every day. That is a invaluable tool for me to have to provide for my family. But I also see it as an invaluable skill. If that was something that my son wanted to grow up and do, I think that would be great. But at the same time, I'm extremely fearful of him being able to get on a computer and access on the internet. You can find anything, whether it be pornography, there's the dark web that people can access now, and you can hire an assassin to kill somebody. You can purchase drugs online. So there's just this infinite fear that I have of giving my child a device that's connected. So how do you figure that out? Where's the line? How do you draw a line in the sand so that they can have these things as tools to enhance their life?
Yeah.
But not to the detriment.
Step by step, starting back with these fundamentals, like Brian has emphasized, the more groundwork you lay early, it makes the later things easier. Monitoring it, and it can be done. I'll speak first to the first thing, and then the second thing, and then we'll need to stop because our time's up. But on schooling, to give you an example, during COVID, they did a lot of things on Zoom. And you might remember in Tennessee, there was a school that sent out a letter that had to be signed by parents agreeing not to listen. Yeah, and parents pitched a fit, or not pitched a fit, but objected rightly, and they backed off. In Philadelphia, one of the school teachers said, this is a video of him talking to other school teachers. How are we going to handle this? Because if you're like me, we've got an agreement in our class. What we say in class stays in class, while we're talking about things like gender issues and stuff. Understand how much some people out there, so take that seriously. I personally homeschool. You can homeschool and do a bad job. You can use public school and do a good job, but you need to be really involved in staying on top and being involved in holding the school accountable. Personally, I preferred to homeschool, but there's real threats out there and not every school district and not every principal and not every teacher is the same, so you gotta evaluate that in your family. Lastly, on the internet thing, I'll share this, they don't have to get into it. Friend asked me a couple of years ago on my teenager, he said, because he'd been talking with some of the boys, and he says, your boy doesn't have a problem with pornography. He said, how did you do that? And partly because I've warned him. And he does have a device now that I trust him with, but I didn't give it to him early. And I talked to him. He's heard me talk about these things. It's not just, oh, I hope he never finds out there's such a thing as pornography. It's like, I've talked, he understands about the dangers of it, and he doesn't want to get involved in it. And so, if you be honest with your kids, be clear with your kids, don't wait too long to talk to your kids, don't entrust them with it too easily, but watch for those signs. Make sure that you can trust your kid. And in the early stages, be checking to see where they're online before they've learned how to, manipulate the system. Early on, get things right, and it'll help things. Thank you all so very, very, very much. We're over time, but I'm going to be in there. If anybody would like to discuss some things further, I'd be happy to. I'd like to thank the elders for the opportunity to come and be here, for all of you for your involvement. I really appreciate it, and thanks for the time today, and see you tomorrow.